This is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, a feature interview with Iranian-American scholar Ervand Abrahamian. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, please help out. Subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor at greenplanetmonitor.net. Now, the news with Kylie Wong.
Iran continues to restrict maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. In the wake of Israel-USA's late February assault on the Islamic Republic, a flagrant breach of the UN Charter, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Tehran aims to keep the vital shipping route open for trade, with possible toll. An estimated 2,000 vessels are stranded in the Gulf. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council is considering a U.S.-Bahraini resolution condemning Iran's interference with international shipping and mandating enforced opening of the strait. The resolution will likely be vetoed by Russia or China, or both. Iran has reached an agreement with China to allow some of its oil tankers to pass through the strait. It should be clear to everyone now that Iran is invincible and will emerge stronger and more united whenever it is put under pressure, said Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. A proposed pipeline deal between Ottawa and Alberta is reviving national debate over whether Canada can expand oil exports, while still claiming climate leadership. Prime Minister Mark Carney has approved the pipeline project alongside a new carbon pricing agreement with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith. The proposed pipeline would transport up to 1 million barrels of earth-warming fossil fuels per day to overseas markets. British Columbia Premier David Eby opposes it, citing environmental concerns, tanker traffic risks, and a lack of consultation with Indigenous communities. The pipeline would not square with Canada's climate goals, critics say. Supporters say it could strengthen the Canadian economy and bolster energy independence amid global trade uncertainty. Carney's pipeline project lacks a private sector developer and faces numerous regulatory, political, and Indigenous rights challenges before construction can proceed. Scientists have been warning about climate system breakdown for years. Now, health experts are joining in. Climate change, they say, is causing deadly heat waves, air pollution, food insecurity, infectious diseases, mental health strain, and extreme weather disasters, all harmful to human health. According to a new report, fossil fuel subsidies contribute to hundreds of thousands of premature deaths annually. A European Commission on Climate and Health is calling for faster emission cuts and public campaigns against climate misinformation. Millions could die without urgent global action, the commission says. The climate crisis may not be a pandemic, but it's still a public health emergency that threatens humanity's very health and survival, says the commission. If we don't act quickly and comprehensively, many millions more people could die or face life-changing illness, says the commission's chair, Katrín Jakobsdóttir, former Prime Minister of Iceland. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith once called for Canada's public health care law to be thrown out. While working as a lobbyist for private health care companies, Smith explored how Alberta could expand private for-profit care, even after being told that federal law prohibits private insurance for publicly insured medical services. Now, critics say that her government is moving in that direction. Alberta's recent Bill 11 allows greater privatization for paying patients. The legislation violates the Canada Health Act, legal experts say, and could undermine universal public health care by creating a two-tier system similar to the one in the U.S. Alberta Premier Smith appears to agree. The Canada Health Act prevents us from moving in that direction of some of the most successful universal systems, says Smith. Canada is facing what LGBTQ advocates call a defining moment, as rising anti-queer rhetoric tests the country's commitment to equality and inclusion for all. Faye Johnstone, executive director of Queer Momentum, says that Canadians should reject recent polarization in favor of open dialogue with the LGBTQ plus community. Johnstone and others across Canada spoke on the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia and said that the country's leaders need to push back against discrimination. Prime Minister Mark Carney needs to speak up for queer and trans rights as other levels of government attack those freedoms, they say. He has not given these issues the time and attention that they deserve, and that is a deep concern, said Johnstone. And that's the news. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Kylie. Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly spoke with U.S. President Donald Trump over the phone. A readout of their conversation has not been released, but we can imagine what the two talked about. Netanyahu, the subject of an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed against the people of Gaza, almost certainly pressed Trump for an end to the supposed ceasefire with Iran that Israel-USA has repeatedly violated. Israel-USA's assault on Iran, initiated late last February, constitutes a flagrant breach of Article 2 of the UN Charter. Will bombs start dropping again? Netanyahu, a staunch advocate of permanent war with his neighbors, does have a knack for pulling Donald Trump by the nose. This past week, the GPM sat down with a distinguished scholar on all matters Iranian. Ervand Abrahamian is a professor of history at Baruch College and graduate center of the City University of New York. He and I sat down at his home across the East River from the United Nations in Brooklyn. There's so much to talk about, Professor Abrahamian, particularly, obviously, in the context of Israel and the United States' assault on Iran. And I refer to the two as Israel-USA. I see Israel and the United States as kind of being conjoined twins. I mean, their arguments, the argument put forward by most countries in the European Union, Western countries, is that Iran is a malign entity. No nation on earth threatens global peace and security, and indeed the future of humanity, more than Iran. How do you respond to that?
You know, Iran's internal policy is despicable. There is no question that what goes on inside Iran, the suppression, the systematic silencing, imprisonment of this group, that group, civil society has been completely stifled.
And has it been?
It has been stifled. But the natural tendency of people to think that if a country's internal policies are despicable, then their external policies are also despicable is not historically accurate. Actually, there are plenty of cases you can in history where you have internal policies despicable, their foreign policy could be ideal, could be peaceful. And in the Iranian case, I wouldn't say their foreign policy is admirable, but it's actually quite rational and quite been forthcoming since 1980-81. At the time of the revolution, there was this feeling in Iran that they had a message to the world and the world was going to listen to their revolutionary message. They quickly realized that wasn't so. And since basically 1980, their foreign policy, the rhetoric has been there, you know, debt to Israel, debt to United States. But
the big Satan and the little Satan.
Yeah. But there, when it comes to actually negotiations, you find that often Iran, even if it's been a conservative government or a liberal government, there have been changes. If the president is liberal or conservative, they've both actually tried to normalize relations with America and Britain and Europe. The supreme leader also might use rhetoric, for instance, the idea about Israel. But even when they're using the rhetoric, you find that their negotiators, the supreme leader's negotiators, are quite happy to sit down with Americans or Europeans and negotiate realistically. So you can actually find incredible number of incidents where the government, and under the auspices of even the supreme leader who's, you know, talking rhetoric, actually worked with United States on crucial issues. So, for instance, give you some examples. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the Iranian government, so supposedly Islamic and so on, should have been supporting the Taliban, yet they supported to help United States, in fact, occupy Afghanistan. So for them, you know, the great Satan, maybe great Satan, but we're willing to work with the great Satan for political reasons. Similarly, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, Iran actually helped U.S. in Iraq. And when there was the ISIS uprising in Iraq against United States, again, Iran helped suppress ISIS, because for them, the Sunni fundamentalists were actually more dangerous than United States. And of course, another case where you can see that Iran was willing to come to a bargaining and negotiations was over the nuclear issue with the Obama period. So if, you know, somehow Iran was a dangerous country that was subverting everyone, wanted to have a nuclear bomb, why did they sit down and negotiate with Obama for a very reasonable, actually, agreement on the nuclear issues?
But, of course, the United States and Israel and European countries say that Iran has got this network of proxies. They're called proxies, Hezbollah primarily, but you know, also Hamas to a certain degree, and Ansar Allah in Yemen. And these are proxies. We don't talk about Saudi Arabia being an American proxy or Israel being an American proxy, but Iran has its proxies, and it executes its malign intentions through these proxies who are destabilizing the region. That's the argument.
Yeah, I mean, if look at the say who are the proxies, the Iranian Revolution did not create an Islamic revolution elsewhere, but in areas where there was a Shia minority, often threatened by a larger community, they had their own issues in their own country. For instance, the Shia community in Lebanon was very much threatened during the civil war, so long before actually the Iranian Revolution. So once those communities, the Shia in Lebanon, you can also find the Houthis in Yemen, the Hazaras in Afghanistan, being besieged minorities, they sort of looked for Iran for help. So they're not really proxies. They were sort of, I would say, threatened minorities seeking help elsewhere. And if you look at actually the history of Hezbollah, during the Lebanese civil war, at least 17 ethnic groups in Lebanon. Each ethnic group had its militia. The only group that didn't have its militia were the Shia, which was the largest community, but they didn't have a military organization. They depended on the PLO, the Palestinian Organization. At that time, was an armed group in Lebanon. So they gave protection to the Shia community. But once U.S. got involved and Israel invaded Lebanon, they forced the PLO out of Lebanon. At that point, then, they had no military protection. And people forget, when they were exposed, there was the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, two refugee camps, which had both Shia refugees and Palestinian refugees outside Beirut. So we all know about the October 6 massacres. Actually, that was about probably 1,000 people massacred in Israel. In Sabra and Shatila, it was more like 3,000 people were massacred. And it was all basically done by Christian fascist militia with the encouragement of the Israelis. General Sharon was in charge of Beirut at that time. So after that, the Shia community in Lebanon really came to the conclusion that the only way they could protect themselves, since there was no PLO to protect themselves, and the Americans were not protecting them, was to create their own militia.
So that was Hezbollah?
That was eventually, I mean, there was something called Amal, which became then developed a larger group, the Hezbollah. And then Iran came to help them. In fact, when Iran sent help to Hezbollah, the instructions Iranians had, this was in training equipment, per instructions directly from Khomeini, is to help the Hezbollah, Lebanese, but in no way get involved in a fighting with Israel and the United States. So it wasn't like directed at Israel or United States. It was actually as a protection of helping protect the Shia community there.
So Iran, in spite of its rhetoric, does not pose a threat to Israel.
Well, after a while, you know, as a way of protecting Hezbollah, they provided short-range missiles, rockets, and that was in a way of protecting Hezbollah. But in terms of threat to Israel, Iran has not really been that involved with the Palestinian issues. In rhetoric, yes, but the idea somehow Iran is behind Hamas or the PLO is a myth. In fact, the relations between Khomeini and Iran and PLO was actually very strained. With Hamas, the idea is somehow Hamas actually attacked Israel in October was done with the Iranian encouragement is, I think, is a complete myth, because if Iran knew anything about Hamas's plans to attack, I'm sure Israelis would have, Mossad would have got wind of it, because they have so much basically infiltrated Iranian networks, they would have known that there was something working. But the fact that Israel, the Israeli government, had completely no awareness that there was going to be attack, for me, is a convincing, basically, evidence that Iran was not involved in Hamas's dealings. And there was also strains between, basically, Iran, Hamas, and Assad in Syria, because Hamas, being a religious fundamentalist Sunni organization, did not get on with Assad, who was a Arab nationalist socialist. Ideologically, there was no affinity between Hamas and Assad, but Iran supported Assad, again, for political reasons. So this sort of blanket idea that somehow Iran is behind every problem that arises in the Middle East, whether it's in Yemen or in the Gulf or in the Levant, is traced to Iran, is I think off the mark, and it gives too much power and credibility to Iran. Yeah, it has some influence, and obviously it provides some help to Hezbollah and so on. But the idea that it actually controls them and they are proxies for Iran is a misreading of the situation. And I think why Netanyahu and Israel latch on to Iran as an existential threat goes into longer history of Israel and the Palestinian problem. And this Palestinian problem has existed since 1948. It's not new. At first, the Israeli position was there is no Palestinian problem because there are no such people as Palestinians. We forget that Golda Meir actually said there are no Palestinians. There are only two-legged animals there. People forget that. I mean, after a while, once the international community recognized the Palestinians as a nation, Israel then accepted that there are Palestinians, but their argument was always the Palestinian problem is really caused by external influence that supports the Palestinian issue. So for a long time, the Israelis argued that Abdel Nasser was the problem. If Abdel Nasser wasn't there, there would be no Palestinian problem. It could be resolved. Abdel Nasser disappeared. Then it was the Soviet Union was behind the PLO of the Palestinians. Soviet Union disappeared. Then it was Assad, it was Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi were behind the problem. If they disappeared, the Palestinian issue would be resolved. One of the arguments used actually for invasion of Iraq, if you read their writings, especially the neoconservative writings, it was going to be a clear break because with Saddam Hussein gone, the Palestinian issue would also be resolved. Okay, somehow, by mystery, this external influence was causing the Palestinian. So after Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Assad disappeared, Iran becomes the obvious target. Somehow the notion is if Iran is no longer there, the Palestinian issue will be resolved. The fact is, I think even if Iran ceases to exist, obviously the Palestinian issue is still going to be there. It's an independent issue. It has its own dynamics. And I think what Israel will do, will find another existential threat to replace Iran. It'll be probably Turkey. Erdogan already talking about basically rebuilding the Ottoman Empire. So Israel will have a ready-made existential threat on its doorsteps. But the whole thing, I think, goes back to the Palestinian issue, which Israel is not willing to address.
How would you contrast American U.S. aims and goals and ambitions in Iran and Israeli aims and goals and ambitions? Are they aligned, the two?
Well, if you look at it logically, that they have different national interests. For Israel, Iran should not exist. They would rather have Iran dismantled, like Libya, like Iraq, basically dissolved into small, petty ethnic states. For that would probably not be in the interest of the United States. But the issue, I think, has been since the Iranian Revolution of 1979 that American presidents have really outsourced U.S. policy on Iran to Israel. Basically, this U.S. has no embassy there. It has no real State Department officials, national security, who know anything about Iran. And this has gone on from 1979 on to the present, with the exception, important exception, of the Obama period. But throughout that period, basically the U.S. has said, if we want to know anything about Iran, we'll basically ask the Mossad, ask Israel for information. They know what's going on. Actually, I don't think Israel knows what's going on, but the presumption is that they have the expertise, they know Iran, they can tell us what we need to know about Iran.
And they've been saying for years and years and years and years that Iran is on the verge of getting a nuclear weapon.
Exactly.
Even though the Supreme Leader said quite categorically in a fatwa that we shall not be pursuing a bomb and it is actually antithetical to Islamic values and we've got the right to enrich uranium, but we're not interested in pursuing nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put that much stress on what they said. The question is verification. There was actually no evidence from monitors that Iran was actually developing a bomb. They were doing research on nuclear stuff, but they were not actually doing anything to create a bomb. And the Israelis knew that. But the whole argument is Israel sold the United States, and this is all the way through with the exception of the Obama period, was that if Iran has any nuclear, basically, research, it's dangerous because that research knowledge enrichment could eventually be developed into a bomb. So the demand the US, Israel had was that Iran should have absolutely no nuclear research, no nuclear knowledge. And they sold that to the American presidents. So during the Clinton period, the Bush period, even though the examples I gave, Iran helped United States, the presidents of the United States followed the Israeli policy that Iran should have absolutely no nuclear research. Okay, that was basically the landmark. As long as that was the demand, no research, they couldn't negotiate with Iran about any type of agreement on nuclear issue. The change came with Obama when he said, yes, Iran can have research, but with the qualification that we have to have verification that research is not going to lead to the to formation of a nuclear weapon. And that caused panic with Netanyahu. That's why he rushed to Washington to oppose the Obama deal, and claimed the Obama deal was too ambiguous, too vague, that it would had limitations on it in times of period. But if you actually look at the deal, it was very precise. The enrichment Iran could have was 3.67%. You can't be more precise than that. It was also limited to amount of 200 grams. Anything extra to that had to be exported, actually, taken out of the country. There were also monitors there, something like 140 international monitors to make sure that there was basically no smuggling of the enrichment. And, of course, 3.67 is way below the 90% enrichment you need to make a bomb. And also the time period, Netanyahu said, well, there was a time period. Actually, the time period, even when it ended, Iran would be still under the non-nuclear agreement, proliferation agreement that they'd already signed. So it was basically a demand that Netanyahu had with America accepted, which was basically a non-starter, because for Iran, it had become a national prestige issue that it had to have its own nuclear research with the qualification that it would not go for a nuclear bomb. So that was, I think, a perfectly good agreement. And if it was kept, this war would not have happened. Iran could have then had normalized relations with the United States. Sanctions could have been basically gradually lifted. Iran could become a normal state in the Middle East. But by withdrawing from that agreement by Trump, it basically created the situation that led to a confrontation.
You are listening to a conversation with Ervand Abrahamian, professor of history at Baruch College and graduate center of the City University of New York. Back to that conversation in a moment.